Welcome back to The Commons. I'm your host, Brian Phillips, here part of the CIRCE Podcast Network for another conversation about school life and leadership. I'm joined today by a very special guest, Dr. Gordon Wilson. Dr. Wilson, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Brian. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. We're going to talk today a bit about the natural sciences and science education, which I think is an area of great need for homeschoolers and classical educators. So, Dr. Wilson, you are a senior fellow of natural history at New St. Andrews College in Moscow, correct, Idaho, right?
Yes.
And you taught at Liberty University for quite some time as well.
Yeah, almost 12 years, 11 okay. and a half years.
Wonderful. So you've worked in science education for quite some time. So tell us your story. How did you first know that you wanted to study the natural sciences and to do it for a living?
Yeah, very early on when we were when I was growing up in Annapolis, Maryland, I was just innately fascinated with life. I remember I was either 5 or 6, and my brothers brought home a couple box turtles from the woods across the street, and I was just riveted. I thought this was the neatest thing in the world. Seeing I remember vaguely a crab from the Chesapeake, and just living things just fascinated me. My mom was Christmas shopping, I remember seeing this thing called the Invisible Man, where you have this, you've probably seen them, those plastic human models that mm-hmm. Are see-through and you see all the organs inside. I don't know if you've ever seen those,
yeah,
but I wanted that. It was just fascinating. So pretty early on, I didn't know what the word biology was, but I just innately had that in me. You know, God put it in, planted it in me. And at various stages through elementary school, junior high, I went through different phases, dinosaurs, reptiles is my main thing, mm-hmm. still is. But that was early on. Yeah, I had a little shark phase during, junior high. Wanted to be a marine biologist for a while. But then I realized somewhere in high school, college, I think it really gelled in my mind in college that everything I learned, I had a insatiable desire to teach. So I could either annoy my mom, dad, my sister by teaching them these things, these facts that they didn't want to know, or I could get paid to do that.
Right.
So that was the choice, either get paid or annoy people.
Or get paid to annoy people.
Oh, yeah, paid to annoy people. And yeah. I really try not to annoy people in my teaching.
Yeah, that's great. So it sounds like you just had sort of a curiosity and mm-hmm. insatiable desire to know more about this. That's wonderful.
And very early on, so I felt sorry for my fellow students who were popping from major to major. It's like I knew what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I was going to do it.
Yeah.
So I switched from biology to biology education because of that realization that I had to teach.
Mm-hmm. Well, with all of that background in science education, then let's talk a little bit about that. A lot of our homeschoolers, a lot of our listeners are homeschooling parents, classical school teachers, somehow involved in classical education.
Right.
And I'm speaking in big generalizations here, but many classical educators are not quite sure what to do with the natural sciences, right? We're great with literature, great with writing, history, the classical languages, but not so much with science. So starting with younger students then, what advice do you have, say, for homeschooling parents or teachers who are providing that early science education? What should they be doing? What sorts of habits should they be cultivating?
Well, at the younger years, and I think this is very adaptable to a homeschool situation, and that is let them explore. If you have scruples about, you know, animals in the house, I mean, we need to just loosen up our standards and really let the children enjoy nature. Many kids, you know, biologists just don't grow out of it, but many many kids just love nature. They want to catch frogs, turtles, and I say let them.
Yeah.
Because the more they actually have hands-on experience with living things, plants and animals, and have the parents, even if they don't know much about it, try to encourage the children to look at details. You know, frog is not just a frog. Some people just, you know, seen one frog, you've seen them all. But it's great to take what is local and figure out, get local field guides and start to learn with your children. Mm-hmm. What are the, and if you don't know, if you can't identify, then work with your child through it. And then if you have nearby colleges or universities, you know, ask experts that would know, or naturalist societies near you. That way you're learning with your kids. They're learning more than just it's a frog or it's a turtle or it's a lizard or it's a, you know, it's a flower. Explore, look at detail. And kids, they just have a natural desire to enjoy that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can squelch that desire by making it all sterile and academic, turn it into a list of objectives. And there's nothing particularly wrong with that. It's just you don't want to squelch that innate love of it. Mm-hmm. So let them explore. Let them, you know, they learn more about raising a bucket of tadpoles into frogs. They learn more than if they tried to learn it in a textbook.
Yeah.
Now, I think that you grow into that, but once they have a real experiential knowledge of this stuff, they may not know the details, the academics of it, but then they've got that foundation you can build upon when they get into the older grades.
Well,
and you can start to systematize it.
Right.
But it's always in the context of enjoyment. And I think too often our curriculum, we become curriculum Pharisees, and the love of learning is squished. Mm-hmm. And we got to be careful that we keep that love of learning alive, right, and on fire.
Yeah, right. If you let them pursue their curiosity, if you let them explore, then the things that you add on and you systematize, you know, the academic side is going to be founded on that curiosity and that love of the thing itself, right?
Yes.
My son Asher, we have four children. Our son Asher is 8, and I think he's going to really love what you just said, because he would spend all day long,
right,
hunting frogs, catching frogs, watching frogs.
Yeah. And you've got to, you know, I understand you have to have school, so it can't just all be a rampage out in the wilds. But taking that knowledge and systematizing it in a way that still causes delight.
Right.
That's great.
Yeah. And the other part of this that I just want to throw in that fascinates me about what you said, or it's an important connection, is that as parents or as teachers, when we're guiding our children or our students into systematizing that knowledge that they're gaining, understanding what it is that they're observing, it's also helping rekindle some curiosity that a lot of us adults have lost along the way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's great.
You know, I remember at Liberty University when I came into a new unit, say fungi, and I always like to connect the the lecture topic with their experience. And so I said, any of you rip open a rotten log and seen white or yellow fuzz growing through it? What's really a shame, and many, many have, but probably more haven't. And I thought, oh, what, that's a tragedy, because I can't connect the more academic side of it to their own experience, because they don't have an experience. The only mushrooms they've seen is in on Super Mario Brothers and on some video game
or on pizza.
On pizza. It's just okay. Let's at least pizza is real, and I can hook that. I actually do hook that.
Yeah.
But anything that you can hook, experiences that you can hook to the academic, it's great.
So how should science education then change or develop as students get older, or does it?
Well, that's I think I'd sort of run ahead. That's what I was mentioning is that at the early years, it's more experiential. Yes, there's knowledge of more of the grammar side of the trivium, where you're learning about what's this, what's that, what's this other thing, starting to know and identify and really honing those observation skills. And then as they grow older, they start to make connections and start to work towards sort of a taxonomy, saying, well, these are, notice that these creatures all have, you can either memorize that they have a backbone, or you can actually, when you're holding these animals, you can, I'm not saying dissect them, but holding these animals, you can feel their bones, and you can start to say, okay, what do all these have in common? This bird and this reptile, and they all have a skeleton. But it's so much better and easier to learn that when you've actually held the creature and you've felt their bones inside their flesh. And now this concept of vertebrate is not something I just memorize. I've experienced vertebrateness, so to speak. And so that's what I, that's how it should shift, is taking that observational knowledge, more grammar, and then starting to tie it together in logical patterns. And move on towards rhetoric. So in, you know, applying that trivium to the sciences of taking all of these parts, learning how to systematize and be able to articulate the things that they've seen in a very coherent, rational way. You know, in the sciences, the way I get students, it's not creative writing. I don't want them to do creative writing. It's science. So I want them, I want it to be written well, but they can write about their observations and detailed observations or life cycles and things that they've, and that means that they have to start to integrate and synthesize the material, but it's all they've got stuff to work with. Because they've got all of that observational knowledge.
Right. Instead of just the textbook memorization.
And the kids that have really gone after it, well, like especially farm kids, you know, that really have experienced biology in a real tangible way, you know, they usually do better, especially if the teacher really hooks them. And they really, they're really cued in to what you're saying, whereas a lot of other people are going, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
They're like, I've seen the inside of a pig.
Right. Those experiences stick with you.
Yeah. And also the kids, you don't have to be a farm kid, but somebody that's been out and seen stuff and has sort of a hobby. Like they're really into this or really into that. Those people really are eager to learn. Some are just kind of punching the clock and saying, got to know this. And that's, that's sad. So that's why everything I do as a teacher, I pour myself into it with as much enthusiasm as I can, because there's nothing, I get absolutely no satisfaction out of teaching someone who's not interested.
Right.
And so I do everything I can to foster an interest.
So letting your kids explore, cultivating that curiosity, giving them as many experiences as you can, and then they can
then begin systematize it.
And sort out and make connections. And that's great. So experiences like my my son's helping me dig a dead fox out from under the barn. That's good experience.
Yeah.
Okay.
They'll learn all sorts about some fox anatomy. They'll learn about decomposers.
Yes. Yes, they did.
Yeah. Bacteria. Not only bacteria and fungi and all of the stench that those things put out, but also, part of the decomposition is maggots and those are fly larvae. So you can, even in that gross experience, they can learn quite a bit.
Right. Well, that makes me feel a little better as a father too, you know, exposing them to that. And here, boys, grab a shovel, you know.
Yep.
So you've done a lot of wonderful work in this regard, as far as maybe not giving hands-on experiences, but exposing and showing this art and beauty of observing creation in the world around us. And I want to talk first about The Riot and the Dance. That's one of the projects that you've done in recent years.
Yeah.
So, and it's gone in a lot of different directions. As far as I believe there's a curriculum, a textbook.
That came first. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The textbook I wrote, I named it The Riot and the Dance. And then when my nephew, N.D. Wilson, asked me to be the narrator, he wanted to name it after the book. Mm. It wasn't necessarily a fight in the sense that I'm the narrator and I'm the author, but, The Riot and the Dance movie is just flat entertainment. I mean, you can learn from it, but it's a cinematic celebration of creation. Whereas the textbook is curriculum. It's, this is a high school, or non-major college text. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about how that got started and its purpose. I know you mentioned that the textbook is for use in high school or perhaps in college, but what was your aim in writing it? My family and I've enjoyed the film, which we'll talk about in just a second, but what was the purpose of that whole project?
The film or the book?
Both.
Okay. The book, real simply put, is I wrote it because I really dislike textbooks. Mm-hmm. I have a love-hate with them. Mm-hmm. I like the knowledge that I can gain from them, but it's written in a sort of a dry, insipid, data dump style. And there's a certain layout of textbooks I don't like. The single space, double column, marginalia, like crazy little insets that are colored that say, all of this other stuff is boring, but let me try to interest you with this little colored box that goes onto some little tangent. It's like, well, you're telling them that the other stuff's not interesting. And so one thing I didn't like is just, besides the writing style, I didn't like the format. I wanted my book to read like a novel. I wanted the pictures to coincide, have very, very small captions, not have the page cluttered with all sorts of bits, figure and a table. And yes, I have pictures, but I didn't want it to be cluttered in such a way that when the student turns the page, he didn't even know what to do. Like, what am I supposed to do next? Am I supposed to read? Am I supposed to read the marginalia? Am I supposed to read the figure? Am I supposed to read? It's like, it's too fragmented. Mm-hmm. And I think they do that and then anyone who writes a textbook follows, monkey see, monkey do, and they just keep following each other in this, I think, ugly format. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's getting more and more colorful, but it's it's fostering some ADD or something, because let's read the textbook. And then I want to read I want to write in a personal tone so that the person reading it will go, oh, this person that's writing is a human being. And he's using analogies and illustrations and anecdotes. And he's sounding like he's just talking to me over the table about these things. And that's how I wanted to write. So I was sort of breaking all the pedagogical rules of writing a textbook, format as well as writing style. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying this is the answer to all of our, you know, science curriculum problem. I was just doing what, you know, based on my ability, which I'm not saying is amazing. I'm just saying I wanted to write a book that I would enjoy reading. If I was a science kid.
Right.
And so that's what I did. I wrote it, and I wanted to title it in a way that also communicates that this is not your typical biology, you know, where it says the title is Essentials of Biological Sciences or something. It was like the riot in the dance.
Right.
Like, what's all that about? And it sort of makes people curious. And so they have to read the introduction too.
Right. now, our family, we love the film that was done, the Ride in the Dance film. So first, when my kids found out that I was interviewing you for the podcast today, they wanted to know, are there more films coming? Make sure and ask him.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so we've we're finished. We've wrapped up number two. And so that, I can't tell you any details other than soon.
All right.
It's coming out.
So soon. Stay tuned. You heard it here.
Stay tuned. Yeah. And it's Riot in the Dance. Well, at the end of the first one, did they see the teaser?
They did. I think they wanted a guarantee.
Yeah. The teaser is real.
Right.
Yes. It's Riot in the Dance water.
Okay.
And it's both fresh and salt.
Okay. Well, and that's good news. Thank you.
And just my personal note, I like the first one a lot. I think number two is better.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was just flat better.
Well, I can guarantee you.
More experience. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm not saying everybody, but, you know, and I tend to be more terrestrial. Person, and I've always been landlocked, so I do like aquatic life, but I'm just more of a land body, and the fact that I like this one more says something.
That does. Well, you've made four Phillips children very happy, that's good.
And I hope that it'll be more than just this one too. Lord willing, as God hopefully blesses this. We will, you know, think in terms of Attenborough in BBC and Planet Earth and Blue Planet. He's in his 90s, well into his 90s. Mm. He's at least 93.
Wow.
And he's still going. So, I mean, Lord willing, if I'm hopefully still doing these types of films into my 90s, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. We look forward to that. Early in the film, you made a statement that I think is really worth stopping to think about, and it's something that you've hinted at already. But I would like to bring it up again. You mentioned that if you wanted to study Michelangelo, you would have to spend a lot of time closely observing his works, right?
Right.
And you've talked about the importance of observation and exploration, but that relates particularly to our study of creation, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we're sort of missing as we approach studying the natural sciences, is that a lot of the wonder and curiosity is sort of sucked out of it because we're seeing this as just an academic exercise.
Right.
What can parents or teachers do, to adjust that and sort of change the expectation, if you will, when it comes to cultivating that wonder and curiosity?
Well, I think it partly has to do with the book, but it really has a lot to do with how the teacher is approaching it. If the teacher is approaching it as, okay, here we go, kids, roll up your sleeves. Here's another, we've got to learn this. And we become slaves of curriculum. I'm all for curriculum. I wrote curriculum, but are we, you know, I think of the verse Jesus said, Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. But I want to sub in curriculum. Curriculum is made for man, not man for curriculum. And I think we really get it backwards. We become slaves of this inanimate book.
Yeah.
That says, and we stress ourselves and we got to get through these objectives and we got to do this. And I would rather have students, you know, there's nothing wrong with being organized, but usually curriculum is, there's usually too much crammed into a certain piece of time.
Right.
And we feel victorious when we've actually checked all the boxes and we've gotten through all the lessons and we've done all the labs and we've done everything. Mm-hmm. And the student, our kids, hate it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, have we been successful here? No. Hmm. But we think we've been successful because we've done all of the units.
Right.
It's much better. You'd say, well, it'd be better to do both. But yeah, I would rather get through 80% or 75% of it and have fostered a love and excitement. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're mesmerized, say, doing a lab with a microscope, and I really, really encourage homeschoolers to get decent microscopes, not Campbell's soup microscope, but decent microscope, you know, Campbell's soup labels where you turn in this, you know,
right.
It's like, get a decent microscope, AMSCOPE, really good, a lot of bang for the buck, good optics, solid scopes. But as they're looking at, say, an amoeba and they're mesmerized, or a paramecium and they're mesmerized, and they're just really enjoying the experience, and we go, okay, enough. We've finished that. You've drawn your little picture. Now we have to go do all these other things. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather have them sit longer at one thing that they're really enjoying than to push them on and get everything done and be, you know, slogging.
Right. Right.
But there's a balance. I mean, I'm all for discipline too, but we've got to have that balance of not being a slave to the curriculum. Yeah. You're the master of the curriculum.
Right. And I think a lot of teachers tend to err on the side of, we want to get through the book.
Yeah. And I've done that. I think we've all done that.
Yeah. So many teachers use that expression of their goal for the years. We need to get through the book as if the science class is like a root canal, you know.
Yeah, or get through the book like we are appeasing this unknown God,
right?
Called curriculum, and we got to get through and do all of our obeisance,
right?
By getting through it, and we have haggard, burnt out kids that hate, and all of this is glorious. The God's creation is glorious. Mm-hmm. And every aspect of it should be pointing us to His glory, but we often separate it, divorce it from Him and His creative work when we're looking at whatever it is, a mammal or a bird or a plant or a reptile. We need to realize that those are that is an architectural design. Mm-hmm. All of it is an architectural design that came from the mind of God. Mm-hmm. And we sort of say, oh, this is biology, as if biology is this separate thing that is not an extension of God's creativity.
Right.
We sort of know it up here, but we don't really think it.
Right. I think if that were really rooted in us, we would probably take a lot more seriously the responsibility we have in keeping mm-hmm. that wonder, that curiosity and love of, yeah. of observing the things around us. That's great.
So I'd encourage parents to just, if anything, if they're haggard, the kids are going to be haggard.
Sure.
So to really, if they have to, weed things down and make it, learn it in hopefully a way that invokes joy in them. And that will be, I think, joy in knowledge will often be, it's contagious. Mm-hmm. Not always, but if the teacher's gifted at it, it'll be contagious.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about one other project that you've put out just recently. There's a book entitled A Different Shade of Green, which was published earlier this year. Oh, wow. Okay. So really recent. In that work, you address some of the extreme reactions and tendencies surrounding environmentalism and care of the environment. Now, this is an issue that tends to invite a lot of extreme responses, and
right.
that's another part of the book that you address. So what are some of the approaches that you've seen when it comes to how we should treat the environment and interact with the creation itself?
Well, I talk about this right off the bat in the book of the various, the spectrum of views mm-hmm. that Christians have, ranging from real anti-environmental, because we associate any kind of environmental issue with leftist, extreme liberals mm-hmm. and their wrong-headed agenda. Mm-hmm. And so we just toss the baby out of the bathwater. And right. so there's that kind of revolt in many Christians. And then there's others that have sort of drunk the Kool-Aid of the environmental agenda. Mm-hmm. And both extremes are wrong-headed. And so I talk about that, and I address that, I think, fairly well. The environment, we often think, well, environment belongs to environmentalists. But if we just change the word and call it creation, it all of a sudden changes our view of it. Wait, is environment separate than creation? No. Well, environment is part of creation. It's a subset of creation that we are interacting with. And we need to realize, if we need to rename it just so we can change our attitude towards it, because we think the environment is just this realm of environmentalists. And
right.
we need to say, the right. earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Mm-hmm. And he's given us dominion. So I try to steer a course, navigate these troubled waters, very controversial waters, mm-hmm. in a way that is just, I'm trying to be as biblical as possible without
right.
falling off of either side of the boat.
Right.
right. Excuse me. So those are the two, often the people that are interested in environmental, that are Christians interested in environmental issues, have too often adopted the view of secularists. Mm-hmm. You know, they become either global warming alarmists, or they, climate change is a big problem, and mm-hmm. they, all sorts of imbalances happen both ways.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always shocking to me how much a thing has changed when it becomes an ism.
Yeah.
Right.
And
environmentalism is no exception. Right. Mm-hmm. So why do you think Christians have had such a difficult time finding our place in the conversation about the environment?
Well, we want to set up the antithesis. And because the environmentalists, which don't have a Christian biblical worldview, they are leading the charge. And maybe they have valid concerns. Mm-hmm. Usually they're exaggerated. Sometimes they have concerns, and they're calling it a crisis when it's not a crisis. And so we see their overreactions and their zeal, and it's all founded on a non-Christian foundation. And so we say, I don't want to be at all associated with that. And right. So we take a sort of a very contrary position, and we need to realize, hey, if we don't like how they're doing it, then we shouldn't just be reactionary cranks. We should be figuring out what our God-given role is in mm-hmm. caring for the creation. Now, I'm not a big political monger. I'm not even a political animal in any sense. So I have no interest in imposing, having Christians set up environmental regs and right. imposing it on everybody. The flavor of the book is more grassroots, not political.
Yeah.
And I want people to be, this ties back into Riot and Dance. I want people to first see the creative aspects of God, love his creation, love God, love his creation, and mm-hmm. be leaders in this area and is saturated with a biblical view, not that we are, that man is a parasite or a virus on the creation. We are to rule it. We are to rule it well. We are to be one thing that usually the word we bandy about in when Christians become concerned for the environment, we usually use the word stewardship. Mm-hmm. And I explain that I don't use that word because mm-hmm. it's not in the Bible. The word is dominion. It's stronger. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that good dominion would look a lot like good stewardship, mm-hmm. but the difference is that, dominion is sovereign rule. Mm-hmm. Stewardship is something where it's on loan and we're taking care of something for somebody else. And to some extent we say, yeah, it's everything belongs to God. But in another sense, God sort of signs the title over to us in Genesis 1. I mean, he gives sovereign rule. We can either rule badly or rule well. And so we need to first love God. And I'm not saying, okay, let's be activists. And I don't do that. I want people to love God, love his creation, and then exercise the principles that I lay out in the book at the level of their influence, their sphere sovereignty. I don't want them to, start agitating for change and become right, activists. Right. That's just not, right. That's not my style. I want it to be grassroots.
Well, that's a good way to fall back into one of the extremes that you talk about earlier in the book, right? So you address a lot of important issues in the book related to the environment, creation itself and our view of that, food, caring for animals, and more. There's a lot of stuff in the book, so that mm-hmm. kind of a encouragement for people to go out and find it. But there's a chapter later in the book entitled "Christianity is the Solution, Not the Problem." Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, I think this is one of the most important sections of the book. For our last question today is, why have some blamed Christianity for environmental problems, or what they perceive as environmental problems? And then why do you argue that Christianity is actually the solution?
I sort of go back to this article written way back. I forget the exact date. Lynn White wrote a book about the ecological crisis. Mm-hmm. It was probably back in the 60s. And it basically lays a lot of the blame on a Christian view of the world. And I think he makes he credits Christianity, and I think this is a true credit, with science and technology. I think that's clear. I write that Nancy Percy really documents that well in Soul of Science, where we have that science and technology arose and grew out of the rich soil of a Christian biblical worldview. Now, he basically said, because the Christian worldview generated this, and because our overbearing rule on the environment has caused so many ecological disasters, back in the old, before the Christian worldview was there, everybody was sort of animistic, if you did something that disturbed the environment, you had to appease the god of the earth or god of the trees or whatever, some sort of oblation. Now, he basically says that a Christian worldview, you can have this mood of indifference towards the creation. And that's where I think he makes an illogical step. Just because we generated science and technology does not mean that it will be used in a Christian way. Mm-hmm. Science and technology is a tool, and it can be used well, or it can be used badly. If you put all of this great power in the hands of greedy people, they can use that power to do a lot of damage, to maximize profits. I basically go against his thesis by saying that greed is not Christian. And so even if you're using tools, like Christians use the internet. We're using the internet right now. But the internet can be used for great evil too. Mm-hmm. It can be used for great good. It can be used for great evil. Right. So that's basically why I think Christianity has been blamed. And I think that blame is just wrong-headed. I think it's false. But I also think that we need to get back in the driver's seat and start exercising godly dominion. We've just too often said they're doing it wrong. They're so bad. The secularists are doing it wrong. But we've abdicated in our global responsibility, and the secularists have, no one was sitting in the driver's seat there.
Right.
And so they just jumped in, and
the car's running. There's just no driver. Right. Yeah.
Right. And they've jumped in, and we get mad at how they're doing it. But if we want to do it under the lordship of Jesus Christ, we have to rethink the issue, think it through in a biblical way, and then I say the solution is the gospel, because once you've reconciled yourself to God, again, I'm steering away from activism. I want people to be reconciled to God. And as they're reconciled to God, a lot of other dislocations will be healed, as Francis Schaeffer says in his book, Pollution and the Death of Man. They will be healed, not just our reconciliation to God, but our reconciliation to our fellow man, that starts to be healed. And then our relationship to nature. We need to be balanced people. There's so many great psalms. I talk about Psalm 104 as being a really good picture of how God views the creation. And I think we need to pattern our view of creation off of that psalm.
Well, Dr. Wilson, I hate that we're out of time. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Well, good.
And it's
I have too.
It's encouraging to me as a father to homeschoolers and as a classical educator myself. So thank you for taking the time to join us. For our listeners, make sure and check out The Riot and the Dance, the textbook, the film, and stay tuned for hopefully very soon. Volume 2, the second film, and make sure to check out A Different Shade of Green, also by Gordon Wilson, just released a couple of months ago. Wonderful book about a biblical approach to Christians' responsibility to the environment, to creation. Mm. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Brian. It's been great to talk to you.
Well, that concludes this episode. So I'm your host, Brian Phillips, signing off for now. Thank you for listening to The Commons. We hope you'll join us again very soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.